All of our problems seem to boil down to this. It's hard to predict the future. If we can't predict the future earnings of a business, then it's hard to place a value on that business. If we can't value a business, then even if Mr. Market goes crazy sometimes and offers us unbelievable bargain prices, we won't recognize them. But rather than focusing on all the things that we don't know, let's go over a couple of the things that we do know. As we discussed, Jason's Gum Shops earned $1.20 per share last year. At a price of $12 per share, our earnings yield was therefore $1.20 divided by $12, or 10%. Easy enough. But what if Jason's Gum Shops earned $2.40 per share last year? What if we could still buy a share for $12? What would the earnings yield be then? Well, $2.40 divided by $12 equals 20%. Therefore, if Jason's Gum Shops had earned $2.40 per share last year at a price of $12 per share, the earnings yield would be 20%. If Jason's Gum Shops had earned $3.60 per share last year at a price of $12 per share, the earnings yield would be 30%. But it gets easier. Now follow closely, because there are only two main points in this chapter. And here comes the question that will determine whether you understand the first. All things being equal, if you could buy a share of Jason's Gum Shops for $12, which of those earnings results would you prefer? Would you prefer that Jason's Gum Shops had earned $1.20 per share last year, $2.40 per share last year, or $3.60 per share last year? In other words, would you prefer that the earnings yield calculated using last year's earnings was 10%, 20%, or 30%? Drumroll, please. If you answered that 30% is obviously better than 20% and 10%, you would be correct. And that's the point. You would rather have a higher earnings yield than a lower one. You would rather the business earn more relative to the price you are paying than less. Wax on! Now that wasn't so hard, but here comes the second point of the chapter, which focuses on something a bit different from the first. Parenthesis. Otherwise, I would be saying the same thing twice, which would be wasting your time, which is something I would never do unless I put it in parentheses. Close parenthesis. The first point related to price. How much we receive in earnings relative to our purchase price. In other words, is the purchase price a bargain or not? But beyond price, we might also want to know something about the nature of the business itself. In short, are we buying a good business or a bad business? Of course, there are plenty of ways we could define what makes a business either good or bad. Among other things, we could look at the quality of its products or services, the loyalty of its customers, the value of its brands, the efficiency of its operations, the talent of its management, the strength of its competitors, or the long-term prospects of its business. Obviously, any of these criteria, either alone or in combination, would be helpful in evaluating whether we were purchasing a good or a bad business. All of these assessments would also involve making guesses, estimates, and/or predictions, as we already agreed that's a pretty hard thing to do. So once again, it might make sense to first examine some things that we already know. In fact, let's not make any predictions at all. Instead, let's just look at what happened last year. For instance, what if we found out that it cost Jason $400,000 to build each of his gum stores, including inventory, store displays, etc., and that each of those stores earned him $200,000 last year? That would mean, at least based on last year's results, that a typical store in the Jason's Gum Shops chain earns $200,000 each year from an initial investment of only $400,000. This works out to a 50% yearly return, $200,000 divided by $400,000, on the initial cost of opening a gum store. This result is often referred to as a 50% return on capital. Without knowing much else, earning $200,000 each year from a store that costs $400,000 to build sounds like a pretty good business. But here comes the hard part. Not really. What if Jason had a friend, Jimbo, who also owned a chain of stores. What if you had a chance to buy a piece of Jimbo's store chain, just broccoli? What if it also cost Jimbo $400,000 to open a new store? But what if each of those stores earned only $10,000 last year? Earning $10,000 a year from a store that cost you $400,000 to build works out to a one-year return of only 2.5%, or a 2.5% return on capital. So here's the tough question. Which business sounds better? Jason's Gum Shops, a business where each store earned $200,000 last year and cost $400,000 to build? Or Just Broccoli, a business where each store earned $10,000 last year but also cost $400,000 to build? In other words, which sounds better? A business that earns a 50% return on capital, or one that earns a 2.5% return on capital? Of course, the answer is obvious. And that's the second point. You would rather own a business that earns a high return on capital than one that earns a low return on capital. Wax off! Or paint the fence, or sand something, or whatever. But here comes the big finish. Remember how I told you this chapter was going to be hard to believe? That by using just two simple tools, you could actually become a stock market master? Well, believe it. You are a stock market master. How? Well, as you'll see next chapter, it turns out that if you just stick to buying good companies, ones that have a high return on capital, and to buying those companies only at bargain prices, at prices that give you a high earnings yield, you can end up systematically buying many of the good companies that crazy Mr. Market has decided to literally give away. You can achieve investment returns that beat the pants off even the best investment professionals, including the smartest professional I know. You can beat the returns of top-notch professors and outperform every academic study ever done. In fact, you can more than double the annual returns of the stock market averages. But there's more. You can do it all by yourself. You can do it with low risk. You can do it without making any predictions. You can do it by following a simple formula that uses only the two basic concepts you just learned in this chapter. You can do it for the rest of your life. And you can choose to do it only after you are convinced that it really works. Hard to believe? Well, it's my job to prove it. Your job is to take the time to listen and understand that the only reason this simple method actually works is that it makes perfect sense. But first, as always, here comes the summary. Number one, paying a bargain price when you purchase a share in a business is a good thing. One way to do this is to purchase a business that earns more relative to the price you are paying rather than less. In other words, a higher earnings yield is better than a lower one. Number two, buying a share of a good business is better than buying a share of a bad business. One way to do this is to purchase a business that can invest its own money at high rates of return rather than purchasing a business that can only invest at lower ones. In other words, businesses that earn a high return on capital are better than businesses that earn a low return on capital. Number three, combining points one and two, buying good businesses at bargain prices, is the secret to making lots of money. And most important, number four, don't give money to guys named Jimbo. In fact, unless Jimbo expects those Just Broccoli stores to earn a lot more in the coming years, a presumption that would obviously involve making predictions about the future, it seems pretty clear that Jimbo's business is so bad he shouldn't even be building Just Broccoli stores. If he has a choice of building a new store for $400,000 that will earn him just 2.5% each year on his investment, or buying a U.S. government bond that will earn him 6% on his investment, risk-free, what's the point of even building a store in the first place? By opening Just Broccoli stores, Jimbo is actually throwing money away. Even though it looks like he's earning 2.5% on his investment in a new store, In reality, he's throwing away the added 3.5% he could earn by simply buying a risk-free U.S. government bond. Chapter 6. So, we're ready for the magic formula. Of course, you're still probably thinking it won't work, or it'll be too hard, or there's something wrong with a book that even claims to have a magic formula. But if it makes you feel any better, even the great Benjamin Graham, one of the most respected and influential pioneers in the investment field, the man who introduced us to the concepts of Mr. Market and margin of safety, wrote about and used a magic formula of his own. Okay, so he didn't really call it that. Apparently the man had some dignity. But Graham felt that most individual investors, and even many professional investors, would have a hard time making the type of predictions and performing the level of analysis necessary to value and invest in businesses on their own. Graham figured that by sharing a simple formula, one that made sense and had worked well in the past, individual investors would be able to achieve excellent investment results with a high degree of safety. Graham's formula involved purchasing companies whose stock prices were so low that the purchase price was actually lower than the proceeds that would be received from simply shutting down the business and selling off the company's assets in a fire sale. He called these stocks by various names: bargain issues, net current asset stocks, or stocks selling below their net liquidation value. Graham stated that it seems ridiculously simple to say that if one could buy a group of 20 or 30 companies that were cheap enough to meet the strict requirements of his formula without doing any further analysis, the results should be quite satisfactory. In fact, Graham used this formula with much success for over 30 years. Unfortunately, the formula was designed during a period when many stocks were priced cheaply. For several decades after the stock market crash of 1929 and the Great Depression that followed, investing in stocks was considered to be an extremely risky business. Investors, for the most part, were therefore unwilling to place a high value on stocks for fear of losing their money again. Although Graham's formula has continued to work over the years, especially during periods when stock prices are particularly depressed, in today's markets there are usually few, if any, stocks that meet the strict requirements of Graham's original formula. But that's okay. By using his formula successfully for so many years, Graham showed that a simple system for finding obviously cheap stocks could lead to safe and consistently good investment returns. If Mr. Market was willing to sell him a group of stocks at prices so low that they met his formula's strict requirements, Graham figured that, on average, he would end up owning a basket of bargains. Sure, the low prices of some of the stocks would be justified. Some companies deserve low prices because their future prospects are poor. But on average, Graham figured that the purchases made by using his formula would be bargains. Bargains created by Mr. Market practically giving away businesses at unreasonably low prices. Graham suggested that by buying a group of these bargain stocks, investors could safely earn a high return without worrying about a few bad purchases and without doing complicated analysis of individual stocks. Of course, that leaves us with an obvious challenge. Can we come up with a new formula, one that can beat the market averages with low risk? Can we find one that not only works in today's market, but one that is flexible enough to work far into the future, regardless of the overall level of the market? Well, as you might have guessed, we can. In fact, you already know what it is. Last chapter, we learned that, all things being equal, if we have the choice of buying a stock with a high earnings yield, one that earns a lot relative to the price we are paying, or buying one with a low earnings yield, one that earns very little relative to the price we are paying, we might as well choose the one with the high earnings yield. We also learned that, all things being equal, if the choice is between buying shares in a company that earns a high return on capital, a company whose stores or factories earn a lot relative to the cost to build them, and buying shares in a company that earns a low return on capital, a company whose stores or factories earn very little relative to the cost to build them, like just broccoli, we might as well choose the one with the high return on capital. So here it comes. What do you think would happen if we simply decided to buy shares in companies that had both a high earnings yield and a high return on capital. In other words, what would happen if we decided to only buy shares in good businesses, ones with high returns on capital, but only when they were available at bargain prices, priced to give us a high earnings yield? What would happen? Well, I'll tell you what would happen. We would make a lot of money. Or, as Graham might put it, the profits would be quite satisfactory. But does it make sense that something this simple and obvious would actually work in the real world? Well, to answer that question, a logical first step might be to go back and see how a disciplined strategy of buying good businesses at bargain prices would have worked in the past. As it turns out, following a simple, common-sense investment strategy actually would have worked pretty well. Over the last 17 years, owning a portfolio of approximately 30 stocks that had the best combination of a high return on capital and a high earnings yield would have returned approximately 30.8% per year. Investing at that rate for 17 years, $11,000 would have turned into well over $1 million. Of course, for some people, that might not seem like such a great return. On the other hand, those people are basically nuts. During those same 17 years, the overall market averaged a return of about 12.3% per year. At that rate, $11,000 would still have turned into an impressive $79,000. While that's certainly a lot, $1 million is more! And you could have made that $1 million while taking much less risk than investing in the overall market. But we'll talk more about that later. By the way, the special database used for our magic formula study, CompuStats Point in Time Database, contains data going back a total of 17 years. It contains the exact information known by CompuStat customers at the time of each stock purchase. Now let's see just how the magic formula was put together. In that way, we can begin to understand why such a simple formula works and why it should continue to work far into the future. Later, we'll learn in step-by-step fashion how to apply the magic formula to find winning investments today. But keep in mind, the mechanics aren't the important part. The computer will be doing most of the work. As you heard in Chapter 1, it will be your belief in the overwhelming logic of the magic formula that will make the formula work for you in the long run. So let's try to understand how the magic formula chooses good companies at bargain prices. The formula starts with a list of the largest 3,500 companies available for trading on one of the major U.S. stock exchanges. Details of this test are provided in the appendix section in the PDF file that accompanies this program. The formula assigns a rank to those 3,500 companies, from 1 to 3,500, based on their return on capital. The company whose business had the highest return on capital would be assigned a rank of 1, and the company with the lowest return on capital, probably a company actually losing money, would receive a rank of 3,500. Similarly, the company that had the 232nd best return on capital would be assigned a rank of 232. Next, the formula follows the same procedure, but this time the ranking is done using earnings yield. The company with the highest earnings yield is assigned a rank of 1, and the company with the lowest earnings yield receives a rank of 3,500. Likewise, the company with the 153rd highest earnings yield out of our list of 3,500 companies would be assigned a rank of 153. Finally, the formula just combines the rankings. The formula isn't looking for the company that ranks best on return on capital or the one with the highest earnings yield. Rather, the formula looks for the companies that have the best combination of those two factors. So a company that ranked 232nd best in return on capital and 153rd highest in earnings yield would have a combined ranking of 385, 232 plus 153. A company that ranked first in return on capital, but only 1,150th best in earnings yield, would receive a combined ranking of 1,151, 1,150 plus 1. The better combined ranking is therefore 385. If you're not a numbers person, don't worry. Just keep in mind that the companies that receive the best combined rankings are the ones that have the best combination of both factors. In this system, The company that had the 232nd best return on capital could outrank the company that ranked first in return on capital. Why? Because we could purchase the company that had the 232nd best return on capital, an excellent ranking out of 3,500, for a price low enough to give us a very high earnings yield, 153rd cheapest out of 3,500 based on earnings yield. Getting excellent rankings in both categories, though not the top ranked in either, would be better under this ranking system than being the top ranked in one category with only a pretty good ranking in the other. Pretty simple, right? But it can't be this easy. Can a portfolio of 30 or so of the highest ranked stocks really get such great investment results? Well, consider this. Over the last 17 years, if we had simply followed the recommendations of the magic formula, we would have made an annualized return of 30.8%. The market during that same time period averaged a return of 12.4% a year. See Table 6.1 in the PDF file for the full details. This can't be. The results are just too good. Surely something must be wrong here. We'll really have to examine these results very closely. But let's say we leave that for the next chapter. For now, we can review the short summary and spend some more time enjoying the results from using the magic formula. They appear to be quite satisfactory. Quick summary. Number 1. Ben Graham had a magic formula. Graham figured that purchases that could meet the strict requirements of his formula were likely to be, on average, bargains. Bargains created by Mr. Markets practically giving away businesses at unreasonably low prices. Number 2. Today, few companies meet the strict requirements outlined by Graham. Number 3. We have designed a new magic formula, a formula that seeks to find good companies at bargain prices. Number 4. The new formula appears to work. In fact, it appears to work too well. Number 5. Before piling every penny we have into the magic formula, we should probably examine the results more closely. Chapter 7. "It ain't the things we don't know that gets us in trouble," said Artemus Ward, a 19th century newspaper columnist. "It's the things we know that ain't so." And that, in a nutshell, is our problem. The magic formula looks like it works. In fact, the results are so good there can hardly be any argument. And of course, we want it to work. Who wouldn't want to make lots of money without trying all that hard? But does the magic formula really work? Sure, all the numbers look good, but do we know where they came from? Or who they've been with, for that matter? More important, do we know where they're going? Even if the formula worked in the past, are we merely learning how to fight the last war? Will the formula continue to work in the future? Good question, certainly. Before what we learned from last chapter gets us into too much trouble, let's see if we can find some good answers. First up, where did all those numbers come from? There's often a problem when looking back and making assumptions about what could have been accomplished in the past. While a computer stock-picking formula may appear to have generated spectacular theoretical returns, duplicating those results in the real world may be quite difficult. For instance, the magic formula may be picking companies that are so small that few people can really buy them. Often, small companies have very few shares available for purchase, and even a small amount of demand for those shares can push share prices higher. If that's the case, the formula may look great on paper, but in the real world, the fantastic results can't be replicated. That's why it's important that the companies chosen by the magic formula be pretty large. Last chapter, the magic formula ranked 3,500 of the largest companies available for trading on the major U.S. stock exchanges. The formula then chose its favorite stocks from that group. Even the very smallest of those 3,500 companies still had a market value, the number of shares times the stock price, of over $50 million. With companies of that size, individual investors should be able to buy a reasonable number of shares without pushing prices higher. But let's see what happens when we raise the bar a little bit. It would certainly be nice if the magic formula worked for companies whether they were large or small. That way, we could be more confident that the basic principle of buying good companies at bargain prices works for companies of any size. So, instead of choosing from the largest 3,500 companies, let's look at just the largest 2,500 companies. The smallest companies in this group have a market value of at least $200 million. Over the last 17 years, ending in December 2004, the magic formula worked remarkably well for this group of larger companies too. Owning a portfolio of 30 stocks chosen by the magic formula would have achieved an annual return of 23.7%. During the same period, the market's average return for this group was 12.4% per year. In other words, the magic formula practically doubled the market's average annual return. But what if we take it one step further? Let's look back and see what happened when we narrowed the group to just the largest 1,000 stocks, only the companies with market values over $1 billion. Even large institutional investors like mutual funds and large pension funds can buy these stocks. You can take a look at Table 7.1 in the PDF file. But to summarize, even the largest stocks chosen by the magic formula almost doubled the market's average annual return. The magic formula portfolios returned an average of 22.9% per year versus the market's average annual return of about 12%. Once again, it appears that even the largest investors can practically double the market's compounded annual return simply by following the magic formula. But this can't be. There must be a catch. It just looks too darn easy. And of course, there may still be some problems. It's just that the problem of a magic formula that works only on paper but not in the real world isn't one of them. Okay, so the companies chosen by the magic formula aren't too small for investors to buy. But how about this? Maybe the magic formula just got lucky with a few good stock picks, and that's why the whole average looks so good. If the magic formula doesn't stay lucky, relying on past results could be very dangerous. Fortunately, it's very unlikely that luck was much of a factor at all. Throughout the 17 years of our study, we held a portfolio of roughly 30 stocks. Each stock selection was held for a period of 1 year. In all, over 1,500 different stock picks were made for each of the tests: largest 3,500 stocks, largest 2,500 stocks, and largest 1,000 stocks. When we combined all of our tests, they are the result of over 4,500 separate magic formula selections. So it would be very difficult to argue that luck was a major factor. But there must be some other problem, right? How about this? While it's pretty nice that the magic formula can find 30 good companies that Mr. Market has decided to throw away at bargain prices, what if it can't? What if those few bargain opportunities were to disappear for some reason? What if Mr. Market simply wised up a bit and stopped offering us those few incredible bargains? If that happened, we really would be out of luck. So let's try a little experiment. Starting with the largest 2,500 companies, what if we ranked them again using the magic formula? In other words, what if we ranked them from 1 to 2,500, from best to worst? Remember, the formula is looking for companies that have the best combination of a high return on capital and a high earnings yield. So the companies that appear to be in good businesses and available at bargain prices would be ranked closer to number 1, while the companies losing lots of money that were offered at expensive prices would be ranked closer to 2,500. Now, what if we divided those 2,500 companies into 10 equal groups based on their rankings? In other words, Group 1 would contain the 250 companies that the magic formula viewed as good companies at bargain prices. Group 2 would be the second highest ranked group of 250 companies. Group 3 would be the third highest ranked group, and so on. Group 10, therefore, would be a group of 250 stocks that the magic formula ranked as being poor companies at expensive prices. So what would happen if we did this every month for 17 years? What if we held each of those stock portfolios, each containing roughly 250 stocks, for 1 year and calculated the returns? Well, as it turns out, the magic formula doesn't just work for only 30 stocks. The magic formula appears to work in order. The best-ranked stocks perform the best, and as the ranking drops, So do the returns. Group 1 beats Group 2. Group 2 beats Group 3. Group 3 beats Group 4, and so on, straight down the line from Group 1 to Group 10. Group 1, our best-ranked stocks, beats Group 10, our worst-ranked stocks, by over 15% a year. That's pretty amazing. You can see all the results in Table 7.2 in the PDF file. In fact, it appears as though the magic formula can predict the future. If we know how a group of companies is ranked by the magic formula, we have a pretty good idea of how well that group will perform on average as an investment in the future. That also means that if we can't, for some reason, buy the top 30 stocks as ranked by the magic formula, it's no big deal. Buying the next 30 should work pretty well also. So should the next 30. In fact, the whole group of top-ranked stocks appears to do well. That may also solve one of our other potential problems. Remember how Ben Graham had his own magic formula? Buying a group of stocks that could meet the strict requirements of Graham's formula was a great way to make money. Unfortunately, in today's market, few, if any, companies qualify for purchase under Graham's original formula. That means Graham's formula isn't as useful as it once was. Fortunately, our magic formula doesn't seem to have that problem. It's merely a ranking formula. By definition, there always have to be stocks that rank at the top. Not only that, because the formula appears to work in order, we're not limited to just the top 30 stocks. Since the entire group of top-ranked stocks does well, there should always be plenty of high-performing stocks to choose from. For those of you keeping score on the sidelines, it's looking pretty good for the magic formula. Come on, that ranking stocks in order thing? Man, that's pretty scary. It's been nice arguing back and forth about whether the magic formula really works, but the winner of that battle is pretty obvious. Maybe we should just stop the fight right now before somebody gets hurt. Alas, not so fast. Sure, the evidence is pretty convincing, but all that means is that the magic formula has worked in the past. How do we know the magic formula will continue to work in the future? After all, with me being such a blabbermouth, why won't everyone start using it? Won't that ruin everything? Well, after we look at the summary, let's see. Number 1. The magic formula works for companies both large and small. Number 2. The magic formula was extensively tested. The great returns do not appear to be a matter of luck. Number 3. The magic formula ranks stocks in order. As a result, there should always be plenty of highly ranked stocks to choose from. The magic formula has been an incredibly accurate indicator of how a group of stocks will perform in the future. Number 4. Next chapter, we'll have to discuss whether the magic formula can continue to get such great results. That would be nice. Chapter 8. I admit it. My knowledge of history is a little fuzzy, though my knowledge of Bob Newhart's old comedy routines is quite good. I guess I should have listened better in class, but there's one part of our history that has always baffled me. I never really understood how we won the Revolutionary War. Here we were, these 13 little colonies, up against the strongest country in the world. England had the best navy, the mightiest army, the most money, and yet our scrappy little ragtag group of soldiers pulled out a victory. How'd that happen? Well, I have a theory. Given my limited knowledge, I don't know whether my theory has been extensively studied, but the way I see it, we won because we were fighting a bunch of complete idiots. After all, the British strategy left a lot to be desired. On one side, you had British soldiers standing in plain sight, perfectly lined up, wearing, of all things, bright red coats, while shooting in unison. I'm sure it looked quite nice. On the other side, you had our guys. A messy, disorganized hodgepodge of soldiers, hiding behind rocks and trees, shooting back at a bunch of conveniently arranged bright red targets. No wonder we won. But here's the part I don't get. I can't imagine this was the first time the British fought like that. In other words, despite what I think, the British way of fighting must have actually worked in the past. My only question is, how? For all I know, they'd been doing it that way for hundreds of years, and apparently, whether it makes sense to me or not, with a great deal of success. Yet following the same game plan that had worked so well in the past clearly wasn't a good strategy going forward. The British found that out the hard way. So what about us? We're about to march off armed with what looks like a great game plan. We have a magic formula that makes sense and has produced phenomenal results in the past. We expect to have a lot of success with it in the future. But before we all line up to collect our money, we better stop and think about one obvious problem. How can our strategy keep working after everyone knows about it? If we can't find a good answer, like the British, we may end up as just another easy target. Well, first, here's some really good news. As it turns out, there are plenty of times when the magic formula doesn't work at all. Isn't that great? In fact, on average, in 5 months out of each year, the magic formula portfolio does worse than the overall market. But forget months. Often the magic formula doesn't work for a full year or even more. That's even better. Imagine buying a book that tells you to invest real money in a group of stocks whose names were spit out by a computer. Imagine diligently watching those stocks each day as they do worse than the market averages over the course of many months or even years. Now imagine deciding, enough is enough. No more trusting that stupid book or that mindless computer. You're going to roll up your sleeves and investigate the companies you purchased and the outlook for the businesses you actually own. As we'll find out later, imagine the horror when you realize that if you had only investigated these companies for a few minutes before buying your shares, there is no way you would have touched many of them. Finally, despite awful performance and the disagreeable prospects of the stocks that you own, imagine vowing to continue following the advice of that stupid book and that mindless computer. But why even worry about all this? After all, the magic formula works. We proved it last chapter. We're going to do really well. So there's no need to worry about months or years of poor performance. And though that sounds right, unfortunately, looking at the statistics for only our very successful 17-year test period, it turns out there's actually plenty to worry about. The magic formula portfolio fared poorly relative to the market averages in 5 out of every 12 months tested. For full year periods, the magic formula failed to beat the market averages once every 4 years. For 1 out of every 6 periods tested, the magic formula did poorly for more than 2 years in a row. During those wonderful 17 years for the magic formula, there were even some periods when the formula did worse than the overall market for 3 years in a row. Think it's easy to stick with a formula that hasn't worked for several years? Do you think the typical reaction goes something like, I know this hasn't worked for a long time, or I know I just lost a lot of money, but let's keep doing what we're doing? I assure you, it is not. Take, for example, the case of the author with the best-selling investment book. For his book, the author tested dozens of stock-picking formulas over a period of many decades to determine which of those strategies had beaten the market over the long run. The book was excellent and well-reasoned. The author then opened a mutual fund based on buying only those stocks picked by the most successful formula of the dozens he had tested. The fund then proceeded to perform worse than the major market averages for 2 of its first 3 years. For 1 of those years, the fund underperformed the market average by 25%. After 3 years, the fund was performing poorly relative to competing funds, and the best-selling author, the guy who did the tests, the guy who wrote the book, decided to sell his fund management company to somebody else. In fairness, I don't think the author gave up on his formula, but clearly he saw better opportunities elsewhere. Had he known that that same fund, the one managed strictly according to his formula, would come back over the next 3 years to be one of the top-performing mutual funds since the time of its inception, even including the tough first few years, perhaps he would have stuck with it longer. But that's not unusual. The unpredictability of Mr. Market's moods and the pressures of competing with other money managers can make it really hard to stick with a strategy that hasn't worked for years. That goes for any strategy, no matter how sensible and regardless of how good the long-term track record is. Let's take a look at the experience of a good friend of mine who happens to be the smartest money manager I know. Though he doesn't automatically buy stocks that his computer-based formula spits out, he does follow a disciplined strategy of choosing companies to buy only from the list of companies his formula ranks the highest. He used this strategy very successfully for 10 years at his previous investment firm, and 9 years ago, he set out to form his own money management firm using the same basic principles. Business wasn't too good for the first 3 or 4 years, as the same strategy that had been so successful in the past drastically underperformed the returns of competing money management firms and the major market averages. Nevertheless, the smartest money manager I know strongly believed that his strategy still made tremendous sense in the long run, and that he should continue following the same course as always. Unfortunately, his clients disagreed. The vast majority of them ran for the exits, pulling their money away in large numbers, most likely to give it to a manager who, unlike my friend, knew what he was doing. As you guessed, they should have stuck around. The last 5 or 6 years have been so good for my friend and his strategy that now the investment record of his firm since its inception, once again including those tough first few years, has trounced the returns of the major market averages over the comparable time frame. Today, it stands among the top of only a small handful of firms with extraordinary investment records out of the thousands of investment firms on Wall Street. To prove that sometimes good things do come to those who wait, my friend's firm now manages over $10 billion for hundreds of clients. Too bad that, in the face of several years of underperformance, most chose not to wait. Only 4 original clients remain. Luckily, I'm one of them. Though, as his friend, I probably had to stick around. So what's the point? The point is that if the magic formula worked all the time, everyone would probably use it. If everyone used it, it would probably stop working. So many people would be buying the shares of the bargain price stock selected by the magic formula that the prices of those shares would be pushed higher almost immediately. In other words, if everyone used the formula, the bargains would disappear, and the magic formula would be ruined. That's why we're so lucky the magic formula isn't that great. It doesn't work all the time. In fact, it might not work for years. Most people just won't wait that long. Their investment time horizon is too short. If a strategy works in the long run, meaning it sometimes takes 3, 4, or even 5 years to show its stuff, most people won't stick with it. After a year or two of performing worse than the market averages, or earning lower returns than their friends, most people look for a new strategy, usually one that has done well over the past few years. Even professional money managers who believe their strategy will work over the long term have a hard time sticking with it. After a few years of poor performance relative to the market or to their competitors, the vast majority of clients and investors just leave. That's why it's hard to stay with a strategy that doesn't follow along with everyone else's. As a professional manager, if you do poorly while everyone else is doing well, you run the risk of losing all your clients and possibly your job. Many managers feel the only way to avoid that risk is to invest pretty much the way everyone else does. Often this means owning the most popular companies, usually the ones whose prospects look most promising over the next few quarters or the next year or two. Perhaps now you're beginning to see why most everyone else won't be using the magic formula. Though some may take it out for a spin, most won't last past the first few months or years of poor performance. As we discussed back in Chapter 1, you're also beginning to see why all that having to believe stuff is so important. If you don't believe that the magic formula will work for you, you'll most likely quit before it has a chance to work. At least, that's where the statistics over the last 17 years seem to point. The magic formula works. Long-term annual returns of double, or in some cases almost triple the returns of the market averages. Only those good returns can get pretty lumpy. Over shorter periods, it may work or it may not. When it comes to the magic formula, shorter periods can often mean years, not days or months. In a strange but logical way, that's the good news. Good news, that is, if you believe enough in the magic formula to stick with it over the long term. But to truly stick with a strategy that hasn't worked in years and years, you're going to have to really believe in it deep down in your bones. Sure, the spectacular track record of the magic formula will help, but let's see what your bones think of the next chapter. Quick summary. Number 1. The magic formula appears to work very well over the long term. Number 2. The magic formula often doesn't work for several years in a row. Number 3. Most investors won't, or can't, stick with a strategy that hasn't worked for several years in a row. Number 4. For the magic formula to work for you, you must believe that it will work and maintain a long-term investment horizon. Number 5. If it wasn't for this chapter, the next chapter would be the most important chapter in the book. Chapter 9. Vomit under the 3M spaces and run. Now there's a saying you don't hear every day. The main reason you don't hear it much is pretty straightforward. Over time, the phrase has lost all of its meaning. In fact, I really only needed it to pass my 8th grade course in print shop. You see, old-time printers used to set type by hand and actually picked letters individually out of a box. To pass the course, my fellow middle schoolers and I were forced to memorize the location of these letters. The letters in the bottom row were V-U-T, then something called a 3M space, followed by the letters A-R. We remembered the order by the catchy phrase, vomit under the 3M spaces and run. With the advent of computers, my little memory device, and print shop for that matter, is now useless. Of course, the world has changed a lot since I was in middle school. No one teaches print shop anymore. Thankfully, though, some subjects haven't changed. Math class, for one, is still pretty much the same. As investors, that's really important to know. That's because in order for the magic formula to make us money in the long run, the principles behind it must appear not only sensible and logical, but timeless. Otherwise, there's no way we'll be able to hang on when our short-term results turn against us. As simple as it may seem, knowing that 2 plus 2 always equals 4 can be a pretty powerful concept. No matter how many people tell us differently, no matter how long they tell us, and no matter how smart all those people appear to be, we are unlikely to waver in our conviction. In a similar way, our level of confidence in the magic formula will determine whether we can hang on to a strategy that may be both unpopular and unsuccessful for seemingly long periods of time. So what is it about the magic formula that makes sense? So much sense, in fact, that we won't waver when things turn against us. Well, let's take another look. The magic formula chooses companies through a ranking system. Those companies that have both a high return on capital and a high earnings yield are the ones that the formula ranks as best. Put more simply, the formula is systematically helping us find above-average companies that we can buy at below-average prices. That certainly sounds logical and sensible. If indeed that's what we're really doing, it also sounds like a strategy we can truly believe in. So let's go step by step and see whether that's true. First, why are companies that earn a high return on capital so special? What kind of companies is our formula telling us to buy? What makes them above average? To understand the answers to those questions, let's go back and check in with our old friend Jason. Last year, as you may remember, was a pretty good year for Jason's business. Each of his gum shops earned $200,000. Since he only had to invest $400,000 to build each store, including inventory, store displays, etc., that meant that his return on capital for opening a gum shop was a pretty impressive 50%. $200,000 divided by $400,000. So what does that mean? Most people and most businesses can't find an investment that will earn a 50% annual return. If the past year is a good guideline, and Jason's company can really earn 50% a year on its money by simply opening another store, that makes Jason's gum shops a pretty special business. Think about that. Having the opportunity to invest your money and earn 50% per year is pretty rare. While it's true that there is no guarantee that Jason's new stores, or his old stores, will continue to earn 50% returns each year on their original cost, Last year's high returns may be a good indicator of the opportunity to earn high returns from investing in that same business going forward. If that's true, and Jason's Gum Shops can continue to earn high returns from its investments in old and new stores, that's really good news for Jason. First, that may mean that the profits from Jason's business don't have to just sit there. While Jason's Gum Shops could take those earnings and invest in a government bond paying 6% per year, they have a much better option. The company can take those earnings and invest them in a new store. So not only will the original investment in the first store continue to earn 50% per year, but Jason's Gum Shops has the chance to invest the profits from the first store in a new store that may also earn 50% a year. This opportunity to invest profits at high rates of return is very valuable. For example, if Jason's Gum Shops earned $200,000 last year, Jason has a few options. He can distribute that money to the shareholders of the business. The shareholders can then invest that money however they choose. If the business doesn't change much this coming year, Jason's Gum Shops will earn $200,000 again. That may be a fine outcome. But if instead Jason's Gum Shops takes its $200,000 in profits and invests them in government bonds paying 6%, 3.6% after taxes at a 40% rate, Jason's business will earn $207,200 this coming year, $200,000 from the store, and $7,200 in after-tax profits from interest on the bond. Though earnings would be higher than last year, the growth rate in earnings would not be very high. But here's where the big bucks roll in. If Jason takes that same $200,000 in profits and can invest it in a new store that earns a 50% annual return, the earnings for Jason's Gum Shops will grow to $300,000 in the coming year, $200,000 from the original store, and an additional $100,000 from the investment in the new store. Going from $200,000 in earnings last year to $300,000 in the coming year would represent a 50% earnings growth rate in 1 year. In other words, owning a business that has the opportunity to invest some or all of its profits at a very high rate of return can contribute to a very high rate of earnings growth. So now we know two important things about businesses that can earn a high return on capital. First, businesses that can earn a high return on capital may also have the opportunity to invest their profits at very high rates of return. Since most people in businesses can invest their money at only average rates of return, this opportunity is something special. Second, as we just learned, the ability to earn a high return on capital may also contribute to a high rate of earnings growth. Certainly, that's good news for the companies chosen by the magic formula. But that still leaves us with one obvious question. If a business like Jason's really can make 50% a year by owning a gum shop, why won't other people see that and start opening their own gum shops? That would mean more competition for Jason's gum shops. More competition could mean that Jason will sell less gum in each of his stores. More competition could mean that Jason must lower his prices to attract business. More competition could mean that someone builds a better gum shop. In short, more competition could mean lower profits going forward for Jason's gum shops. In fact, that's how our system of capitalism works. Good businesses attract competition. Even if competing gum shops open up and the return on capital from opening a new Jason's gum store drops to 40%, the threat to future profits might not end there. Earning 40% annual returns from opening a gum shop is still quite good. People might see those 40% annual returns from opening a gum shop as very attractive and decide to open their own gum shops. Then, due to the increased competition, returns may fall all the way to 30% per year from building a new gum shop. But even there, it might not stop. Earning 30% a year on an investment is also good. More competition could continue to drive down future returns on capital from new stores and from old stores that are already built. This whole capitalism thing could result in profits continuing to spiral downward until the annual returns on capital from owning gum stores isn't so great anymore. Some system. But here's the thing. If capitalism is such a tough system, how does the magic formula find us companies that are able to earn a high return on capital in the first place? To earn a high return on capital, even for 1 year, it's likely that, at least temporarily, there's something special about that company's business. Otherwise, competition would already have driven down returns on capital to lower levels. It could be that the company has a relatively new business concept, perhaps a candy store that sells only gum, or a new product, like a hot video game, or a better product, such as an iPod that's smaller and easier to use than competitors' products. A good brand name. People will happily pay more for Coke than for Joe's Cola, so Coke can charge more than Joe's and continue to earn a high return on capital, despite having competition. Or a company could have a very strong competitive position. eBay was one of the first auction websites, and has more buyers and sellers than anyone else, so it's hard for new auction sites to offer the same benefits to customers. In short, companies that achieve a high return on capital are likely to have a special advantage of some kind. That special advantage keeps competitors from destroying the ability to earn above-average profits. Businesses that don't have anything special going for them, such as new or better products, well-known brand names, or strong competitive positions, are likely to earn only average or below-average returns on capital. If there's nothing special about a company's business, then it's easy for someone to come in and start a competing business. If a business is earning a high return on capital and it's easy to compete, eventually someone will. They'll keep competing until returns on capital are driven down to average levels. But the magic formula doesn't choose companies with average returns on capital. It doesn't choose companies with below average returns on capital either. Businesses like Just Broccoli are unlikely to earn a high return on capital for even 1 year. So by eliminating companies that earn ordinary or poor returns on capital, the magic formula starts with a group of companies that have a high return on capital. Sure, some of the companies chosen by the magic formula won't be able to maintain their high return on capital. As we just learned, businesses with high returns on capital tend to attract competition. Also, even mediocre businesses can have a good year or two and temporarily achieve a high return on capital. But on average, the high return on capital companies chosen by the magic formula are more likely to have the opportunity to reinvest a portion of their profits at high rates of return. They are more likely to have the ability to achieve high rates of earnings growth. They are also more likely to have some special competitive advantage that will allow them to continue to earn an above-average return on capital. In other words, on average, the magic formula is finding us good companies. And what does the magic formula do with this group of good companies? It tries to buy them at bargain prices. The formula chooses only good companies that also have a high earnings yield. A high earnings yield means that the formula will buy only those companies that earn a lot compared to the price we are paying. Buying above average companies at below average prices. It sounds like it should work. But how do your bones feel about that? Quick summary. Number one, most people in businesses can't find investments that will earn very high rates of return. A company that can earn a high return on capital is therefore very special. Number two, companies that earn a high return on capital may also have the opportunity to invest some or all of their profits at a high rate of return. This opportunity is very valuable. It can contribute to a high rate of earnings growth. Number three, companies that achieve a high return on capital are likely to have a special advantage of some kind. That special advantage keeps competitors from destroying the ability to earn above-average profits. Number four, by eliminating companies that earn ordinary or poor returns on capital, the magic formula starts with a group of companies that have a high return on capital. It then tries to buy these above-average companies at below-average prices. Number five, since the magic formula makes overwhelming sense, we should be able to stick with it during good times and bad. And finally, number six, if you must vomit under the 3M spaces, don't forget to run. Chapter 10. I love sailing. I'm not very good at sailing. I know this, not just from the fact that my wife and kids are scared to go with me, but from hard experience. Once, through a slight miscalculation of wind and water speed, I was 20 feet away from being slammed by a barge at least 3 football fields long. I remember this quite well, because I had my wife as a passenger, who hates boats anyway, while I was busy pulling the starter cord on my little 5-horsepower out.